are Locked On Seahawks, your daily Seattle Seahawks podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Greetings, 12s. This is Corbin Smith, your host for Locked On Seahawks. Joining me, as always, my co-host in crime, Rob Rang. Unfortunately, it's another Misery Monday. I'm getting way too many of these during the early stages of the season. This one feels especially miserable because the Seahawks had an opportunity to steal a road game in primetime in Pittsburgh, got to overtime, made a stunning comeback in the second half, but weren't able to quite finish it off. And lost 23-20 at Heinz Field. Rob and I will be breaking down some takeaways from that game. And of course, as always on our Monday episode, we'll be tackling your mailbag questions, answering as many as we can. So let's get to it. Thanks for making Locked On Seahawks your first listen every day. We are free and available on all platforms. Now for your lead story here on Locked On Seahawks. The Seahawks dropped their fourth game in five tries on Sunday night, losing a 23-20 heartbreaker to the Steelers. But that really wasn't the biggest storyline coming out of the game last night. Unfortunately, late in the fourth quarter, defensive end Daryl Taylor going in for a tackle on Najee Harris, dives the running back, his head struck teammate Al Woods. And we know Al Woods is a big man. If you hit him the wrong way, he's going to inflict some damage on you. His neck got bent awkwardly there. Rolled over onto his back, was on the ground for several minutes. A really scary situation. Players from both teams circled around him. They had to call out a cart and put him on a stretcher. They stabilized his head, removed his face mask from his helmet. All of those things are part of the protocol when there's an incident like this. But it seemed like this was one of those worst case scenario type situations. And you were just simply hoping that Daryl Taylor was going to be okay. You weren't even worried about him playing football again. You're just hoping that he'd be able to walk again. It was one of those really scary situations. And the good news, Rob, is it does look like he has managed to escape serious injury. In fact, Pete Carroll said today that there's a chance he might be able to suit up against the Saints next Monday night, kind of similar to what happened with Michael Bennett back in 2013. Very similar situation where he was carted off on a stretcher and he played the next week. Taylor didn't necessarily want that. He wanted to get up on his own, but the training staff was not going to allow him to do that. And sounds like he's avoided a serious injury, which is very fortunate news.
Yeah, it's fantastic news. I think that when Daryl Taylor went down and we saw them bringing out the cart and everything, and he's on the spinal board, that's obviously the most horrific thoughts start going through your mind. So fantastic news that Daryl Taylor has gone through all the CT scans, everything. You could see that he had the feeling in his arms and his legs when he was down on the field. So you had that initial comfort. But then as they continue to go through the process, putting him on the board and driving him off, and then the NBC cameras caught the ambulance driving away, to the local hospital. I mean, very frightening kind of thing. So I think there was kudos to Pete Carroll. He typically does not share a lot of medical information at the conclusion of a game, but did so with Daryl Taylor, at least giving the positive initial reviews that he had received at that point, and shared that Daryl Taylor would be traveling with the team back to Seattle. So again, all very, very positive news, but unfortunately, while that news is great for Daryl Taylor, and if he is able to play against the Saints this upcoming week, then that would be that much better, because obviously he is one of the only productive members of Seattle's pass rush to this point, but also, unfortunately, there were some other injury news for Seattle. Damian Lewis, the left guard, going down with the injury. We saw Jamarco Jones step in as his replacement. We'll talk about that a little bit later. But I think that we have to talk about Alex Collins as well. The fact that he went down with the injury, he's been arguably Seattle's most consistent offensive player so far this season. So the fact that he went down this game and wasn't able to play late is a huge storyline to follow as well.
Yeah, the good news on that front is that based on what Pete Carroll said today, he did not confirm whether or not Collins is going to be available on Monday. They're going to be playing that out the next several days to see how he recovers. But he said that he avoided significant injury he was dealing with a glute issue as well as a hip problem late in the game last night. And Carroll said today he also had some cramps going on as well. But he really has been, since getting some extended playing time a few weeks back in San Francisco, he's really been their most consistent player on offense. And he became the first running back since Chris Carson in December 2019 to surpass 100 rushing yards in a game. So he continues to resurrect his career in the Pacific Northwest. And the offense, as well as DJ Dallas played, as well as Travis Homer played. I mean, Homer did some great things with like five offensive snaps yesterday. Had a 26-yard reception in the first half. Second half had a really nice run on a draw play on third and seven that picked up big yardage. So both those guys played well, but they certainly missed, and we'll talk about this more in the third quarter, but they certainly missed Alex Collins' presence late in the fourth quarter and in overtime, because he was shredding the Steelers' defense. And so if he's going to be out for any extended period of time, and right now I don't think that's what the case is going to be. Maybe he ends up missing one game, but based on what Carroll said, it sounds to me like he's probably going to have a pretty good chance to be available against the Saints. They've also got Rashad Penny coming back off injured reserve next week. At least that's the game plan. So they'll have another back that's going to be available to take a little bit of the load off of Collins, so he doesn't have to have 20-plus carries. But the way he's been running, you want him to have the football that much because he's been playing really well. So that's an injury to monitor. The Damian Lewis situation, I think, is the one that's a bit more murky just because he's dealing with a shoulder issue that the Seahawks are not sure right now whether that's going to be a 1-3 week thing or if he's going to be able to return this week. The fact that he couldn't finish this game, I thought, was a little bit ominous, but they ended up putting Jamarco Jones in, and he did some nice things, had a crucial penalty called against him, but thought he played pretty well in his first extended action at guard this year. He was a big part of them running the ball well the way they did, but certainly that is an injury to monitor because we know how important he is to the offensive line, particularly the run game. So going to be watching all three of those players going into this week to see whether or not all three are going to be available, whether only one or two of them are going to be available. Those are all key players for different reasons for a Seahawks team that's already dealing with significant injuries without Russell Wilson and Chris Carson. They've been banged up on the defensive side of the football as well in a number of different spots. So this is a team that is hoping for some more positive injury news, but certainly they've gotten that with Daryl Taylor. And I think what they were provided today on Alex Collins is good news as well.
No, I agree. I think that considering how scary those injuries initially appeared, then this is positive news. And then again, with Damian Lewis, we'll be talking about this a little bit later, but I did think that that was a critical injury. You and I talked before the game in our key matchups about just what a player that Cameron Hayward is. And he certainly demonstrated that. Jamarco Jones won his fair share of battles, but Hayward won more of them and some of the critical ones down the stretch.
When we return in the second quarter, as we do each and every Monday, Rob and I are going to be tackling your questions in our Locked On Seahawks mailbag segment. We'll answer as many as we can in the second quarter. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. Does this sound familiar? You've got one device that lets you catch the game live, another that lets you stream your favorite shows. You're watching sports highlights on your phone, and you've got your neighbor's best friend's login for the good stuff. Well, I want to tell you about a simple way to get all the entertainment you love without the hassle, and it's a great way to finally get your TV together. It's called DirecTV Stream. It brings live TV and on-demand favorites together like never before, so you can watch your favorite sports, movies, and shows all in one place. That means no more juggling remotes, no need to buy another device ever again. And the best part, there's no annual contract. So get rid of the clutter and the confusion. Get your TV together with DirecTV Stream. You can learn more at DirecTV.com. That's DirecTV.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, Monday edition. This is your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. It's time for our weekly mailbag segment. We got a ton of great questions from the 12s going into today's show. Obviously, plenty of negativity out there with the Seahawks dropping to 2-4 on the season, but we got some positive questions as well. So we're going to try to spread the love a little bit and not make this all a beating down the Seahawks session. Because certainly, as we'll talk about in the third quarter, there were plenty of positives that came out of last night's game as well. First question coming from Robin Solari writes, with all the hype and hope for Shane Waldron to shake up the Seahawks offensive play calling with play action, the use of tight ends and jet sweeps, The Colts game gave us hope, but since then the play calling seems pretty uninspired. What gives? I don't know that it's been uninspired. Maybe the biggest thing I've noticed, and this might just be because Shane Waldron had never been a coordinator higher than the high school level when the Seahawks hired him back in January. Like the rest of the offense, it seems like he is inconsistent with his approach. We see a couple quarters at a time where there's a ton of pre-snap motion, and you see the run game's got some deceptiveness to it, and then you see a lot of play-action bootlegs, more under-center plays. You see the things that fans were clamoring for, and then you'll have a quarter or two where the offense is really stagnant. You don't always have to have pre-snap motion. I'm not going to sit here and say if you don't have motion, then the play is not going to be successful, but certainly fans wanted to see more of that under Shane Waldron. But it does feel like some of those new wrinkles, especially the tight ends getting involved, have been very hit and miss. And I just got to wonder if it's more about growing pains for the coach than anything else, because this is his first time being a play caller at a college or NFL level. And that's going to take some time, even with the experience that he had with Sean McVay. And I think you add in the fact that the players are all adjusting to this system as well. And, oh, by the way, now they got a backup quarterback in that is running their offense. When you add all those factors together, I think that's why you have seen the inconsistency. That we're getting to the time of the year now, going into week 7, where you would think that players are really going to start picking up the offense. You'd think Shane Waldron's made his adaptations, the adjustments he needs to make, and really finding his groove. Maybe this second half against the Steelers will be what kind of carries that over, with them getting back to the run game more than what they have done at any point this year. But it does seem like it's been a little bit hit and miss. I don't necessarily think it's anything to panic about because of him being a new offensive coordinator, players still adjusting. You had to expect growing pains. But if this is prolonged a few more weeks into the schedule, especially when Russell Wilson gets back from his finger injury, then I think the panic level starts to escalate, especially if they're still losing games and they push themselves further out of the playoff race.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. And that kind of ties right into our second question from Mike Sent, who says, do you think if a team finishes with between 4 and 6 wins, they should move on from Pete? And, you know, if the offensive production doesn't improve, and assuming that Russell Wilson comes back and plays a significant number of those games and Seattle still finishes with a 4-6 record, then I think that you do have to kind of not only be looking at Pete Carroll, but also, again, shifting the attention back to Shane Waldron. This is assuming that Russell Wilson is back. Then you have an all-pro quarterback. You have two Pro Bowl wide receivers. You have an offensive line that has shown signs of being significantly improved from the last couple of years. And then it almost feels like the Mike Shanahan or Kyle Shanahan show, I should say, at the running back position, basically whoever Seattle has used at running back, whether it be Chris Carson, whether it be Alex Collins or DJ Dallas or Travis Homer, and I have high expectations for Rashad Penny as well, that it seems like Seattle has been able to run the ball at least somewhat consistently. And so I really think that, coming back to Mike Sent's question, that if the Seahawks do finish that poorly and Russell Wilson's a starting quarterback, then there has to be some kind of internal conversations. But let me be very clear. I think that Pete Carroll has earned the right to basically call his own card when he is ready to move on. I don't think that there's anybody in the Seahawks organization, with the exception of the owner, Jody Allen, that really has that responsibility, has the right to tell Pete Carroll when to move on. I think that he has earned that, and that barring an absolute complete collapse from the Seahawks, if they do not fight back, then maybe you could have that argument. But otherwise, I think you are going to continue to see the Seahawks show the resiliency that they showed in coming back from that early deficit against the Steelers and taking that game into overtime. To me, that was the most frustrating thing about that game. And we'll talk about this a little bit more in the third quarter, but it did feel so winnable at the end of the game. And that's not the way it felt at halftime. So to me, that's a testament to Pete Carroll's coaching, not a detriment.
Yeah, we're going to continue to hear this type of noise with the Seahawks losing games. That's just the way it goes with coaches. So we'll see how things unfold. There's still a lot of football left to be played. Cash for the K writes, who will be more impactful coming back from injured reserve these next couple of weeks, Rashad Penny or D. Eskridge? This is a really difficult question because both of these players have injury histories. Unfortunately, Eskridge dealt with some injuries at Western Michigan High School. He got banged up a little bit. And this is a concussion that Many of us thought he would have been back a few weeks ago and ended up being a pretty severe one. So those are always worth monitoring long term. We don't know when he's going to be back. The Seahawks are being very cautious about that, as they should be. And Rashad Penny, it's been almost 2 years since the last time we saw him really make an impact for this offense. We know that he's got talent, but he can't stay healthy. So if I had to make a prediction here on which player is going to have the best chance to make an impact out of those two, I think that we're going to see Penny back this next week. And if Collins is banged up, then we might see quite a bit of Rashad Penny as long as he can stay on the field. So I'm going to go with Penny. If we're looking, obviously, long-term prognosis by the end of the year, the hope is that Dee Eskridge is back and he's making a big impact on offense as a receiver and getting a few carries a game as well. But right now, I would think, especially with him being a few weeks behind on that injury reserve timeline, Rashad Penny is probably the player of those two. Given the running back situation, Chris Carson's already on injured reserve. Collins is banged up. I think Penny's got the best opportunity here to make an impact for the Seahawks. Now the question is, can he stay healthy long enough to actually be able to do it? That's been the million-dollar question for him his entire time in Seattle, unfortunately. Next question here coming up here for Rob. This is from Embrace the Rebuild. We're starting to see a lot of Twitter handles like that with the Seahawks starting 2-4. What's the percentage chance that worst case scenario, we don't make the playoffs and Russell Wilson and Pete Carroll decide to run it back? Or in other words, they miss the playoffs, but both the coach and quarterback are back in 2022.
Well, I think it's very good that Seattle is not going to make the playoffs, considering the fact that right now, obviously, they're 2-4 and are looking up ahead of everybody else in the NFC West division. The Arizona Cardinals look like they're running away from things, and you already had the loss against the Los Angeles Rams. So I think that it is unlikely at this point, barring a miraculous comeback, that Seattle is going to make the playoffs. I just don't think that that's very likely right now. Could change. We've seen turnarounds like this happen in the NFL almost every single season. But as I just mentioned before, I do not think that it is unlikely the Seahawks are going to be moving on from Pete Carroll unless he decides to retire, which I don't think that there's no indication that I've seen from his energy level to his enthusiasm to his just competitive drive that suggests that he wants to move on. I think that there is some talk about Russell Wilson moving on. Obviously, we all went through this offseason where there was all these reports that he and his agent had all this list of teams and all those different things. But at the same time, I don't know that Russell Wilson can make the same argument that the team is floundering around him when he is the guy with the injured finger. So I do think that there is a good chance that the Seahawks miss the playoffs, but I think there's even a better chance that Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson are going to be back, at least the way things feel right now.
Tim writes, what do you think we need to do to improve our pass rush? Blitz Bobby Wagner more, keep bringing Jamal Adams, or is it just a matter of our guys up front needing to produce? So, I think that there's two aspects to this. I don't necessarily believe that the Seahawks should be blitzing Jamal Adams 25% of the time. I've never made that argument. I did not think they were using him enough in that capacity until last night. And he had a couple promising blitzes on Ben Roethlisberger last night. None of them yielded quarterback hits, but I liked how they played him last night compared to how they did the first four games of the season. That's more how I would expect a smart defense to use a player of his skill set. I don't think Bobby Wagner needs to blitz a bunch more either. To me, this boils down to the players up front. Darrell Taylor has been the one consistent player rushing off the edge. He has 4 sacks. Pro Football Focus has given him 14 pressures to this point. He has been the one constant for them. But otherwise, Alton Robinson's been dealing with a sore knee. He has not done much the last couple of games after getting off to a pretty good start. Rasheem Green has done nice things in the run game, but hasn't done much as a pass rusher. Not really the biggest strength in his game anyway. Benson Mayoa has been slowed because he missed a few games with a neck injury, and he hasn't looked quite right the first two games coming back. But really, there's one player I'm going to circle here. Carlos Dunlap had such a great impact on this defense a year ago when they acquired him from the Bengals. He had 5 sacks in the last 8 regular season games. The Seahawks led the NFL in sacks as a defense after he arrived in the second half. And a big part of it was because of his presence. It really helped the rest of the defensive line. But we're now 6 games in the season. And Rob, he has 3 games with no statistics where he's played significant snaps. I'm saying no tackles, no quarterback hits, no tackles for loss, no pass breakups. He's had three of the six games. He has done nothing. Now, there might have been a few promising quarterback pressures in a few of those games, so he wasn't completely irrelevant, but he has not lived up to the contract that they gave him, re-signing him on a two-year deal. He has been a non-factor for most of the season. So I feel like that's your biggest issue right now. They are not getting the production from that front line they thought they were going to get. In particular, the player that was such a catalyst for the group a year ago in Carlos Dunlap has been a ghost for a good portion of the 2021 season. They need the veteran to step up. If he can't, you got to wonder if last year, that second half, was kind of his last hurrah. Maybe that was the last gas that he had in the engine, and now he's just running on fumes. It's possible, now that he is in his 12th NFL season, that that's what's going on. But I didn't see any indication in training camp that was going to be the case. He just has not played well in the early stages. So they need more from their front line, not necessarily more blitzing. That leads to other issues for your defense. So the front line's got to do a better job moving forward. And the last question here for Rob, coming from KC, and you were so excited about this question going into this mailbag. How do we trade Jamal Adams, and how fast can we trade Jamal Adams? It is, you know, I understand he has not played well, but it's just crazy how the fans have quickly turned on number 33.
Well, it is, and I think justifiably so. I mean, given all that Seattle gave up to acquire him in the first place, the financial implications of the contract that he signed, and the fact that Jamal Adams continues to just kind of proclaim himself as being a great player, and there's just not been any evidence to kind of back that up. I mean, he literally had a potential game-winning interception come off of his face mask. He proclaimed himself as the best safety in the nation. I believe that's what he said. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was his that Louisiana accent. Maybe he said the bust safety in the nation. I don't know. But it was, for those people who don't know what I'm talking about, during the NBC pregame, typically players get an opportunity to say their name and which college they went to. Sometimes players show a little bit of flair by instead saying the high school that they went to. Jamal Adams, if I am quoting him correctly, he said, "I'm the best, I thought, best safety in the nation." And again, it just, when you say things like that, when you ask for the limelight, then the light is going to shine on you. And there's a reason why Seattle continues to get beaten over the top by tight ends. They continue to get to give up plays in the passing game. Coming back to Casey's question, I think that every team in the league right now, Corbin, is seeing that Jamal Adams is not living up to his contract. So how do you trade Jamal Adams? I don't know how you're able to trade Jamal Adams until he plays better. And at this point, I don't know when that's going to happen. So I think that this is a very difficult situation. And I would argue that even bigger need for the Seahawks is to figure out what's going on with Jamal Adams and how he can be more productive. An even bigger concern than the defensive line issue that you mentioned previously. I think you get Jamal Adams right, that defensive line magically will start making more plays as well.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel on all this. It still seems like the team has not used him quite correctly, but you can't have interceptions bounce off of your face mask like that one last night. I mean, just he isn't making the impact plays, and you're paying him to be an impact superstar. They're not getting that from him right now. So it's understandable why fans are getting frustrated. At the same time, all it would take for him to get things going is one really good game. Maybe that'll be coming up here in New Orleans, and he can get things rolling. But we'll just have to wait and see. For right now, I think it's going to be very hard. If you wanted to move him, I don't know that anybody's going to be absorbing that contract that they just paid him, given the way that he has played these first six games of the season. When we come back in the third quarter, it's time for our takeaways. The Seahawks dropping to 2-4 with a 23-20 overtime loss to the Steelers at Heinz Field. Rob and I will be reviewing the good, the bad, and the ugly from Sunday's game in primetime. You won't want to miss it. You're listening to the Locked On Seahawks podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
We're back and better than ever. All eyes are on the gridiron as teams are back for another football season. As always, BetOnline is your number one spot for all the pro and college football action this season. With a new updated site and interface, even more odds, props, and contests, BetOnline continues to be the number one source for everything football. Head to the website or use your mobile device to sign up today to receive your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Don't forget to use our promo code LOCKEDON to receive your bonus. From football, basketball, boxing, right to your favorite Vegas casino games. Don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for the 2021 season. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on all your favorite sports. BetOnline, where the game starts.
Did you know that Built Bar has 9 delicious flavors? If you talk to a Built Bar fanatic like myself, we're definitely passionate about our favorite flavors, whether it's cherry, raspberry, my personal favorite peanut butter brownie, salted caramel. There is something for everyone. If you haven't tried all the flavors, you should buy a mixed box where you'll get 2 of each of the 9 flavors. Not only are Built Bar flavors the best tasting out there on the market, they're also healthy too. 17 grams of protein, only 130 calories, only 4 grams of sugar, and only 4 grams of net carbs. It's the perfect snack for a workout. Even if you don't work out, it's not going to be something that destroys your nutrition. Go to BuiltBar.com and use promo code LOCK15 and you'll get 15% off your first order. Use promo code LOCK15 for 15% off at BuiltBar.com. Welcome back to the Locked On Seahawks podcast. It's our Monday show. I'm your host, Corbin Smith, joined as always by Rob Rang. The Seahawks had an opportunity last night to steal a road victory against the Pittsburgh Steelers. They were down 14-0 at the half. The offense was completely punchless, but they came out and they managed to tie the game twice in the second half, took Pittsburgh to overtime, had possession of the football twice, weren't able to do anything with it, unfortunately, and a late fumble by Geno Smith allowed the Steelers to get a short field goal and escape with the 3-point win. So Seattle is now 2-4. They are 4 games behind the Arizona Cardinals in the NFC West. They're 3 full games behind the Rams. Things are looking pretty ugly for the Seahawks playoff chances. Right now, there are only 2 teams in the conference that have a worse record than Seattle at 2-4. So obviously not the start that they were expecting, but oddly enough, there's a little different vibe coming out of this game than there was a week ago in that loss to the Rams. Rob, it really seemed like there were a lot of positives to take from this football game. And again, there are no such things as moral victories in the NFL. You either win or you lose. That is the bottom line. It is a bottom line business. But given the circumstances and the fact this team was down 14-0 at half, they could have packed it in. They didn't. They had opportunities to win in the second half. And that's really a testament to the resiliency of this ball club.
Yeah, I think so. I really think that, that it looked like Seattle was going to get run out of the building there for a while. And instead, they started doing the running. And that, to me, was, as you just said, a test of their resiliency. And I thought that they passed that test. I love the fact you mentioned Geno Smith. And obviously, anybody who watched the game saw that Geno Smith fumbled the ball. And that's how Pittsburgh was in position to kick the game winner, and that's your ball game. But I thought that the resiliency specifically from Geno Smith was one of the more impressive things in this game. I mean, I went back over the 2 victories that when Russell Wilson was, you know, captaining the ship, so to speak, and he never threw completed passes to 10 different receivers the way that Geno Smith did in this particular game. So I love the ball distribution there. I love the fact that that the Seattle just seemed like no matter who was the running back, that they were able to gash the Pittsburgh Steelers, a team that is known for being such quality defense. And how do you silence a road crowd? You run the ball right down their throat. So to me, there were definitely some positives from this game that you could feature, we could be talking about. And then before we go any farther, you have to mention the play of Trey Brown. The cornerback has been such a position of huge concern for the Seahawks for his really NFL debut, for him to play as well and as physically as he did. To me, that is one of the absolute best takeaways from that game.
I thought Trey Brown and Alex Collins yesterday were the MVPs for the Seahawks. And Trey Brown did not play a lot in the first half. This was his first regular season game. He just got activated off the 50 or to the 53-man roster off injured reserve, had never played a regular season snap on special teams or defense, but they subbed him in their third possession. He made 2 quick tackles, and then Ben Roethlisberger, like any experienced veteran quarterback tends to do, decided, you know what, I'm going to pick on this rookie that's never played an NFL game, tried to beat him with a fade route to Diontae Johnson, and Trey Brown played that textbook perfection. I mean, he got his hips turned, and then he used his back as a guard. He boxed out the receiver, which is completely legal. I mean, he was still running downfield, but he was not allowing Deontay Johnson to be able to get downfield, but he wasn't turned and blocking him or anything. There wasn't pass interference. It was just really well done from a technique standpoint. And then, of course, the play that he made in overtime, and he talked about this after the game with reporters, they were in quarters coverage, and he was defending the curl route from Chase Claypool, but he knew that when Ben Roethlisberger was rolling out to his right, that the only throw that he had to make because the way his shoulders were squared up was the dump off to Ray McCloud. And so he shot like a cannonball upfield, makes a perfect tackle, blasted McCloud at the line of scrimmage, and then the Steelers have to punt. So it gave the Seahawks a second opportunity in overtime directly from Trey Brown's efforts. And so I thought he played fantastic football. I think he now is your starter at left cornerback. I don't know how they can go back to Sidney Jones. And not that Sidney Jones did anything wrong in this game before he got banged up, but Trey Brown is a rookie that's got a lot of upside, that was climbing the depth chart before he injured his knee in training camp. So he looked pretty darn good on the outside. I thought DJ Reed had a great game as well. Two pass breakups. There were two different times Roethlisberger tried to stretch him out downfield, and he managed to get his hands in the football. He's just so much more comfortable on the right side. So maybe, just maybe, with Trey Brown at the left cornerback spot and DJ Reed in his comfort zone at the right cornerback spot, maybe there is now hope at that cornerback position. So that, to me, was the biggest positive on defense, aside from the fact they also held Najee Harris to 3.4 yards per carry. That's an impressive feat as well. I thought the defense as a whole, for the most part, played pretty well in this game. And the offense in the second half was much better when it leaned on the ground game. Geno Smith was 15 for 18 in the second half, throwing the football. He had a 21-yard dart that he threw to Tyler Lockett in overtime over the outstretched hands of Devin Bush. It was one of the better throws you'll ever see. So he looked much more comfortable once he was able to play off of that ground game. And so there were positives to glean on both sides of the football that gave the Seahawks a real chance to win this game. And unfortunately, they just couldn't make quite enough plays to finish off the comeback.
Yeah, I know that is obviously the unfortunate aspect of it, is that as good as you might feel about the resiliency, you know, at the end of the day, it's still a loss. And so I think that that's one of the things that when we shift over here to the bad, that is obviously the bad, is that it still is a loss. But to me, one of the frustrating things about it, and there's two things I really want to make sure that I talk about here. For one, just the inability to get any type of consistent pressure on Ben Roethlisberger. And Pete Carroll was you know, kind of explained it away as Pittsburgh's scheme, as far as the way that Ben Roethlisberger all year long statistically has been able to get the ball out of his hands faster than any other quarterback in the league. Well, that's great. But at the same time, that it's still, you are paying all of these defensive players to be able to get some pressure. They had, Seattle had a great many blitzes in this game, and they were not able to get home. And considering the fact that Geno Smith was hit on approximately a third of his dropbacks, and Ben Roethlisberger was basically as clean as he's ever been. I mean, the only, you know, turnover, the only real hit on the quarterback was when he drops the ball, trying to do his classic little throw and re-release kind of a motion that he's done for years and years. I mean, it's just absolutely inexcusable. The Seahawks need to get more pressure on the quarterback, and until they can do so, they are going to continue to have losses. But you know me, Corbin, I usually am kind of anti-hot takes, but here's my closest thing I have to a hot take from this game, is that when the Seahawks did win the challenge and got the ball back off of that aforementioned Ben Roethlisberger fumble, which absolutely, at least in my opinion, was a fumble and the right call, I thought, you know, what's going to happen here? The Seahawks fans that have watched the way the Seahawks have played against the Pittsburgh Steelers in the past knew that there was going to be a makeup call come on and to kind of appease the home crowd. And on that very next play, it was Jamarco Jones who got called for that phantom holding penalty that they showed that just wiped away all of the momentum that Seattle had. And couple of plays later, Seattle's punting the ball again, and it almost felt like a victory for the Pittsburgh Steelers at that point, because they took that Ben Roethlisberger fumble and instead got the ball right back. So the opportunity to have momentum shift to Seattle Pittsburgh took it right back. And I thought the refs, just like a Super Bowl a few years ago, the refs had a hand in Pittsburgh being able to get that momentum right back.
I think that that was clearly a hold. My issue with it is that it happened when Alex Collins was already like 5 yards downfield. It did not at all impact the actual run. So that was what my problem with that holding call was. Was it a hold? Yes. But the timing of it, I feel like there's no reason to throw the flag because it had no bearing on what Alex Collins did. That should have been a 19-yard run that went into the red zone. And we probably are having a much different conversation right now about the Seahawks pulling off a stunning comeback because I think they would have scored a touchdown the way that the offense was moving, especially the run game. But that really put them behind the eight ball. Suddenly it was first and 20. And then they were not able to get anything going. So really that classifies for me the bad is just the missed opportunities because obviously after that turnover in Steelers territory, you want to score at least 3 points, and the Seahawks didn't get anything out of that. So that was killer. The end of the half, I still don't know what DK Metcalf was doing when he tried to continue running down the sideline instead of going out of bounds and then fumbled, nearly cost his team a chance to tie the game. If he would have just gone out of bounds, Geno Smith probably could have taken one more shot to the end zone before they brought in Jason Myers. Again, there's a chance, what if maybe the Seahawks could have scored a touchdown and we didn't even have overtime? But DK Metcalf did not allow that to happen by not getting out of bounds. Then you have the Jamal Adams face mask interception drop. That to me was another huge. I think he had a pick six there if he gets his head around and he actually sees the football. Pete Carroll was saying, you know, he was defending the receiver. He was reading the receiver, didn't see the ball. But it's another case where he just does not have the ball tracking skills that a lot of your elite safeties do. And he showed it again there by taking a fastball right in the face mask. And Pete Carroll was saying how loud it was in the sideline. And that's not a good thing for your safety to have that happen. But there's just three things right there in the second half that I think totally changed the complexion of this game. The Seahawks were gifted opportunities by the Pittsburgh Steelers and Ben Roethlisberger, and they did not take advantage of them. When you're already shorthanded and you have a very slim margin for error as a result, you can't have stuff like that happen where you don't capitalize and expect to win games. The Steelers got short field position once, and it just happened to be that fumble at the end. And sure enough, Boswell kicks the game-winning field goal. That's your difference. The Steelers took advantage of that opportunity, the quick turnover. The Seahawks couldn't do anything with it. And they had a couple other chances they could have made turnovers, and they didn't capitalize.
Yeah, and that's where I would say was the ugly here is that, again, this was a winnable football game and that you had two of the highest paid defensive players in all of the NFL basically going head to head, not literally because they both obviously played defense, in TJ Watt and in Jamal Adams. And you had one player where the ball literally bounces off of his face mask, as we've referenced so many times already and will continue to reference, I think, all year long. And then with TJ Watt, he just showed why he is the highest paid defender in all of the NFL. I mean, he was an absolute menace in this game. I thought it was fitting, frankly, that he was the one that forced the fumble after being basically triple team blocked. And then they just show his awareness, his resiliency, and his impact ability. To me, it was such a stark contrast to what number 33 has been able to provide the Seahawks so far this season.
And I'm sure plenty of fans saw him wreaking havoc off the edge, getting three pass deflections and thinking, oh, the Seahawks had a chance to draft him when he was coming out of Wisconsin, and they didn't draft him. So certainly all those type of conversations are always hindsight, and it is what it is. But TJ Watt is one of the best pass rushers in football, and putting Brandon Schell on an island against him a couple times wasn't fair to Brandon Schell. The results were extremely predictable, finding Geno Smith in the backfield and really disrupting a number of drives. So just a lot of missed opportunities. The offensive line as a whole, at least in pass protection, did not play well in this game. Run blocking was a little different story in the second half, but those were the things that ultimately were the Achilles heel. I thought the defense played more than well enough to win this football game. The offense just couldn't make quite enough plays down the stretch to cap off this comeback. And as a result, the Seahawks are now 2-4. They got a big hole to try to climb out of if they want to get back in the playoff discussion. Thanks for making Locked On Seahawks your first listen every day. Now make your second listen to Peacock and Williamson NFL Show. Brian Peacock and former NFL scout Matt Williamson give you the expert NFL analysis in less than 30 minutes. It's free and available on all platforms. You can follow me on Twitter at CorbinSmithNFL. You can follow Rob at Rob Ring. Make sure to check out Locked On Seahawks on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and the all-new Audacy app. That's AUDACY. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to return to our normal Tuesday programming. Throwback Tuesday, we're going to look back at the last couple times the Seahawks and the Saints got together. Haven't played since 2019. We'll revisit a few of those past matchups. We're going to take a look at what's new with the 2021 Saints. A lot of big changes there moving out of the Drew Brees era. You won't want to miss it. Thanks for listening in. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Go Hawks.